Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Leslie Hazelton on the show, and we'll be talking about her new book, After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split. You've probably read in the newspaper or seen on TV something about the so-called sectarian conflict in Iraq. And you may even know that it pits the Shia Muslims against the Sunni Muslims. I confess that I did not know a lot more about it than this. I was vaguely aware that there were two branches of Islam, but I didn't know the whole story. Now that I've read Leslie Hazelton's excellent and very writerly and readable book, I know a lot more about it. After the Prophet died, it was left to members of his extended family to decide what Islam should be. And it was an open question because he had not been very specific on the matter. There were lots of open questions. There were also personalities involved, full-blooded people who had ambition and desire, who wanted things done their way, who allied with other people, who were hurt, who were wounded, who were right, who were wrong, who were healthy and who were sick. And all of these things came together after Muhammad died to shape Islam. And in a very significant way, significant for us, insofar as the way that events transpired resulted in the division of Islam into two major groups. And those major groups are the ones that are fighting or were fighting in Iraq. This is really what we sometimes call the backstory, but it's not so much the backstory as it is the story. It kind of reminds me of the expression, I think it was Twain, who said, "The past isn't over, it's not even past." Because this is a past that really lives with us, and it lives with the people of Iraq today. And Leslie does a wonderful job of explaining the origins of this particular division. So without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Good. Well, let me tell our listeners that we have Leslie Hazelton on the air today, and we'll be talking about her terrific book, After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split. I learned a tremendous amount from this book. Part of that has to do with my ignorance of Islamic history, but much more of it has to do with Leslie's ability to tell a story very cleanly, yet very entertainingly, if I can make up a word. I don't think entertainingly is a word, but I just made it up. And I really did find the book a kind of a page-turner, to be honest with you. Leslie has a kind of a writer's ability that I think many people that write history don't have. I don't. I can tell you that for a fact. This is a book that you can pick up and actually read, even when there are other people around, say in an airport lobby. The books I write, you cannot do that. You have to sit down and cloister yourself and probably drink a lot of coffee to keep you awake, but not this book. You can read this book, and I think you'll really enjoy it, and you will learn a lot from it, as I did. So, Leslie, thank you very much for writing it. Let me ask you to begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, big question. Big question, because, you know, usually one's meant to have a sort of life story that's nice and sort of in a linear progression. And mine is sort of much more Byzantine. It sort of goes in and out all over the place. But I born in England, obviously from my accent, educated in England. Spent 13 years in the Middle East, mainly in Jerusalem. Then 13 years in New York, and now, to my astonishment, a lot more than 13 years in Seattle. I trained originally as a psychologist, so my professional qualifications are as a psychologist, but I've worked as a journalist, particularly Middle East journalism, for a long time, and then began this terrible habit of writing books.
Yeah, it is a terrible habit. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the books heretofore before After the Prophet, if you'd like to. You can say
well,
no.
No, that's fine. Since about 2000, I've been focusing on an area that really fascinates me. I should tell you right now, I have a blog called The Accidental Theologist, accidentaltheologist.com, and I describe it as an agnostic eye on religion, politics, and existence. And that, just about the way religion and politics, this vast and volatile arena, the way these two things sort of rub up against each other and jostle with each other just absolutely fascinates me. And, you know, looking on it from the outside, as it were, as an agnostic, seems to give me a particularly curious eye. Let's put it like this.
I see. So would you call this your sort of main theme these days? That is the intersection of religion and politics?
Yes. I mean, what happened was that about 10 years ago, I wrote a book about Mary, as in Virgin, which was subtitled A Flesh and Blood Biography. I wanted to know who she really was, not that sort of icon, you know, and blue silk and pearls and so on, and sort of, you know, very European looking in the niches of the convent school where I, you know, oh, yeah, I was educated in a convent. I should tell you, I'm Jewish, an agnostic Jew educated in a convent school. Confuse everything even further, talking about a central story in Islam in After the Prophet.
Right. Well, that we'd make you an honorary American just on that basis alone.
Right. You're hyphenated. So I wrote the book about Mary. My question there was, you know, I think every good book really starts with a question, and a question that the writer is really, really curious about and begins to obsess about and goes deeper and deeper trying to find the answer to. And what I wanted to know was, who was she really, this 13-year-old peasant girl in first century Palestine? That was my question, and that's what led me deep into that book. And then after that one, I sort of, it's almost as though I came at the same question from the other direction. I got obsessed with Jezebel, and I wanted to know, who was she really? You know, so the one is the epitome of all virtue, and the other the epitome of all evil. And in fact, of course, neither is quite, you know, as simple as that. And it turned out that Jezebel was equally fascinating in her own way. This Phoenician princess from the most, you know, sophisticated civilization in the world at the time, married off to the king of this backwards podunk kingdom called Israel up in the hills, which just happened to have control of the main trade route from the Red Sea to Damascus, Greek, Turkey, and so on, and therefore was very, very important. And what happened when she moved to Israel? Very much, and that of course is very much a story of a cultural clash and resentment and so on. So those were the two books that came before After the Prophet. So one was about a Christian subject, the other about a Jewish subject, since it's based on the stories in Kings, the clash between Elijah and the prophet Elijah and Jezebel. And how come, of course, Jezebel got thrown to the dogs and eaten by the dogs by the walls of her palace and so on, which I find a fascinating image. And then I without actually planning it, I did not plan to sort of do a tour of the world's great monotheisms or something, but then I found that the next book after the Prophet was focused on Islam, on early Islam.
Well, let me say, you're doing all of us a great service by really sort of translating these kind of complicated stories, they are complicated stories, into a frame in which we can really understand them. And I can understand them as somebody who knows virtually nothing about the Middle East.
They're wonderfully complex stories, which is why they've lasted for so long.
Yeah.
Emotionally, they go very, very deep, the way we react to them and so on.
Yeah.
There's no way that, you know, any story can last unless it does that. And this is why basically all history is story.
Yeah. It's funny because there's a moment in your book which I really, really liked, and that is one of the things that you point out is that even shortly after the prophet dies, and shortly, that could be anywhere from 10 to 20, 30 years and anything like that, the people on the ground didn't know what had happened. They were confused. And so they go about reconstructing a story, and it turns out two very different stories about the prophet's relationship with Ali. And this makes all the difference in the world because they don't remember what happened exactly, and we can't really know what happened exactly. So
they do and they don't. It's the method. Okay, what happened? First, I'll tell you how I got into.
Let me take a step back.
I got interested in this, and then we'll go into the. This magnificent history that I discovered, written in the late 9th, early 10th century by Al-Tabari, this famed and revered early Islamic historian.
Okay, you tell us how you came to write the
method.
Book. Hmm? Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so what happened was, after the Prophet really began with a question posed by a friend of mine, who was trying to persuade me to write a book about Muhammad, a biography of Muhammad. And I said, you know, with all due respect and so on, I am not qualified to write a book about Muhammad. And he was trying to persuade me that I was and so on. And I began to read biographies of Muhammad, which are, it's kind of difficult because most of them are hampered either by too much reverence and too much piety or by a kind of almost a fear on the part of non-Muslim writers of sort of overstepping a boundary or something like this. So they're very dry and you never really get a sense of the man himself, which I think is a shame because it's an absolutely wonderful, I mean, it's an amazing life that he lived. And he was an amazing person, quite obviously. But, you know, we got together again and we were talking and I was talking about Muhammad and so on. And he said, you know, here's the question, he said, and this was shortly after a particularly horrendous series of suicide bombings in Karbala in Iraq, which is, by the way, the cradle of Shia Islam. The cradle, you might say, of the split between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam. And his question was as follows. He said, how come Muhammad, as you say, the prophet of unity, one God, one people, could leave behind him, at the moment he died, could leave behind him this terrible, blood-soaked, seemingly unending legacy of division between Shia and Sunni? And that was the question that hooked me, that began to obsess me. And I began to read deeper and deeper, looking for an answer to this question. I'm still not finding it, because the trouble is, you see, that we suffer in the West from what I call the nutshell syndrome. Yeah. Okay, you're very familiar with that, right?
Yeah.
Can you just tell me in a nutshell what it was all about, right?
Uh-huh.
Oh, it was a dispute over the succession to Muhammad.
Yeah.
That leaves you very much the wiser, doesn't it? Oh, it was a dispute between his family and his community. That doesn't leave you any the wiser either. So the nutshell version tends to come in maybe maximum a paragraph. Usually a couple of sentences and something, sometimes just something really dismissive, like you know, some dispute over succession to Muhammad. And none of this was, to put it mildly, at all satisfying. So I began to read deeper and deeper, and that's when I went back to the source and discovered that this magnificent early Islamic history by Al-Tabari had been translated into English, God bless him, in a series of 39 volumes,
wow,
which took all of the 1990s to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, closely annotated and so and footnoted. And I began to read Al-Tabari. And it was amazing. It was like this, it just leapt to life, this whole story. It was so vivid and so compelling and so detailed. It was written, it's written in a very Middle Eastern style. It's written in a style that I know most Westerners would not be able to stand, almost what you would call a Byzantine style. It goes round and about. In fact, it's a very postmodern kind of style, because what Al-Tabari did was he traveled all throughout the Muslim Empire at the time, talking to people and basically taking oral histories. The first time most of it was being written down. And by then, of course, it was several generations later, say 3, 4, 5 generations later. So he was very, very careful to record what is called in Arabic, in Islam, the isnad, that is the chain of communication. That is, A will say, I heard this from B, who heard this from C, who heard this from D, who was there when it happened. And then E will say, well, I heard this from G, who heard it from H, who heard it from D, who was there when it happened, right? And then you have both of them go back to D and so on. So you can trace the way these stories come down. They'll be told in a mainly non-literate society, which is not to say unsophisticated. We tend to confuse literacy with sophistication. And in fact, the 7th and 8th century Islam was immensely sophisticated because it was based on, I mean, for instance, today, we we're somewhat puzzled that there are so many Muslims who can recite the whole of the Quran by memory, by heart. This was common in the 7th and 8th centuries. It was common before literacy. People's minds were the repositories, not actual books. It's almost as though with literacy, we forgot how to remember. We forgot how to hold large amounts of information in our head because we can always go and look it up. in those days, it was all in your head, and you remembered. I mean, I have listened, and still in non-literate, contemporary non-literate societies, like Bedouin societies, or what's left of them now, but I remember, like, you know, 40 years ago in the Sinai, listening to Bedouin elders recite traditional Bedouin poems by heart, ones that lasted for hours on end, mm-hmm. hours, and entirely by memory. Mm-hmm. And it was just so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's ended now because their children weren't interested in learning them and so on, and their children mm-hmm. became literate and, you know, went into the towns and so on. And there's a whole society coming to an end right there in the 20th and 21st century. But I'm getting way off the point here. Back to Al-Tabari. So what Al-Tabari does is he'll tell it from one person's point of view first, and then from another one's, and then from another one's. And you may have like 12 or 15 different versions of the same event, and each one is told, you can hear that person speaking, the particular personality telling it. Some of them remember direct speech, which makes it even more vivid. Some of them have give you, you know, such a sense of the language and the thought of the time. You know, you can read oaths like, you know, may your mother be bereaved of you. Mm-hmm. Just saying that, the little chills go down my spine mm-hmm. when I think of that. I mean, what a terrible curse that is. And so vivid. And others are sort of tell more, you know, the general story from more of a distance and so on. It depends, of course, on how good they are at telling stories. But the thing is that all these stories agree in the main details, some of more detail than others. Some one person might remember the scene of a battle where a young man comes out to do a single combat, and he'll remember the glint of the boy's earring in the sunlight. Or he'll remember that one of his sandal straps was broken, and then he'll add, the left one, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So you see what I mean about mm-hmm. the kind of detail that's in here, which just... It was such a discovery, and I realized what I had to do was to tell the story in a way that Western readers could appreciate the depth of it and the power of it. Because, as I say, any story that's lasted for so long, for 1,400 years, we know it has to have the most incredible depth and power, the power to resonate, to hold the imagination, for its main scenes to be so very, very symbolic, as the ones in this story are.
Mm-hmm. So then, let's actually talk about the story. Where should we start the story of the Sunni-Shia split?
Ah, well, where we... I don't know. I'll tell you where I started.
Yeah, where do you start it? Yeah, that's fine.
I started with the death of Muhammad. At age 63, probably a meningitis, though it's not quite clear, but it was an illness that lasted 2 or 3 weeks, and he was... fading, sort of, you know, until then he'd been in very, very good health. And it's as though it had not occurred to anybody that the Prophet was going to die. You know, he had achieved so much. He really had united the fractured tribes of Arabia. And Arabia was poised at that point, just perfectly poised to surge out northward, because what happened was this was at exactly the time that the Byzantine and the Persian empires had exhausted each other from decades of fighting, and the dividing line between them being more or less where Syria and Iraq are today, especially Iraq. So what you were finding was these two rapidly fading empires, and thus a vacuum of power, just at the time that the Arabia was becoming united and beginning to experience this the sense of national identity as Arabs and as Muslims, so almost poised, ready to surge out north, and not to any kind of foreign territory. It has to be said here that, you know, there's a strange image still in the West that 7th century Mecca and Medina were somehow, you know, isolated, backward, primitive places. You know, you just use the word tribe and everybody thinks, you know, it's a synonym for primitive. In fact, you know, the tribal organization is incredibly sophisticated. And Mecca in particular made its fortune by trade. It was a merchant city, working on the camel caravans. Now, perhaps you have to have lived in the desert, as I did for a year, to really appreciate camels, you know, without them becoming, you know, just, oh, camels, ha-ha. They are the most incredible animals. But there we go, you know, from Mecca, month-long journeys down to Yemen and up to Damascus and then back again. And of course, you know, when they got to Damascus, they did not do like the modern equivalent of a touch-and-go at Damascus airport, right? They settled in. This is how you did business then. You traveled for a month. You settled in for at least a month or so. You gave hospitality, you received hospitality, you talked, you learned, and you found out what was happening in the world. I mean, if you look today at the Wall Street Journal, for instance, or the Financial Times, those two newspapers have some of the best foreign coverage in the world, if not the best. And the answer is quite simple. You know, if you ask why, it's quite simple. You cannot trade successfully without knowing what is happening in the world. Mm-hmm. It is essential politically, culturally, socially, and economically. There are no dividing lines between these things.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, the merchants of Mecca were incredibly successful because they were connected, because they did know what was happening and so on. Now I've forgotten where I came from.
Well, you came from where we were going to start the story, and Muhammad dies, and then what happens?
Yeah. Ah, that's it, Mr. Vacuum. Everything is poised, right? And it's as though, as I say, as though nobody realized that he was actually mortal, that he really was going to die. There is the most strange scene around his deathbed where it's as though everybody wants him to clearly appoint a successor. I have to say clearly, because Sunnis say that he did, and Shia say that he did, but they say that it was different people, of course. An unequivocal announcement of who would lead the Ummah, the community of Islam, after his death, was, so far as I can see, not quite made.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as though everybody gathered there around his deathbed wanted him and yet didn't want him to say it unequivocally. It's as though they were afraid of what he would say. And what happened was that there were two main contenders. One was Ali. And Ali was both his cousin and his son-in-law, married to his favorite daughter, Fatima. And Ali was probably the single man closest to Muhammad, and was also the first man to accept Islam. But on the other hand, the Sunnis say, and why do I focus on Ali here? Because a Shia, when we talk about Shia, Shia is actually short for Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali, or the followers of Ali. But there was another man involved too, Abu Bakr, who was one of Muhammad's earliest followers. And well, Sunni will tell you he was the first man to convert to Islam. And he was Muhammad's father-in-law by then, because Muhammad's youngest wife was Abu Bakr's daughter, mm-hmm. Aisha. And they, too, were very, very close. And Abu Bakr was also a man held in very, very high repute, as was Ali. So the Sunnis say that actually the man he really indicated should be a successor was indeed Abu Bakr. So there is the most strange scene right after his death where a shura has been called, a council of all the tribal elders and leaders to decide what to do now. And everybody goes to the council. Some go to the council, and then the council is kind of gatecrashed by one faction. And meanwhile, Ali is sitting with the body of Muhammad, so doesn't go. It is, the whole scene is so strange, and yet it's strangeness, you know, just the image of the body of Muhammad just there in this room with just Ali and a few others of his closest family and nobody else around while everybody else is off trying to figure out, okay, who's going to take power now and so on. It's very human and it's very real.
Mm-hmm.
You can sense it happening. It's people confused, trying to figure out what to do, getting all the more confused and so on, until eventually what happens is by a kind of, you know, you could say a kind of political sleight of hand, Abu Bakr was, the consensus landed on Abu Bakr, except it, of course, was not a full consensus. So And all this before Muhammad is even buried.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange. And the strangest thing, too, is that when he was buried, it was Ali and Ali's closest relatives who buried him, and nobody else was there.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as though, in fact, Aisha, you know, relates hearing them, hearing the pickaxes in the middle of the night. He was buried in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Though no great state funeral, as it were, but just, you know, very gently and quietly slipped into the ground, mm-hmm. before somebody could claim to make a big thing of a big show out of his funeral.
Mm-hmm.
A very, very strange and very haunting sequence of events going on there.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question that I was just a little bit confused by this, and perhaps because I bring a Christian perspective to this, or perhaps Judeo-Christian perspective, and that is, what were these people succeeding to? If you see what I mean. In other words, you know, I understand the succession of kings and presidents are elected and so on and so forth, but the prophet was, he wasn't the first prophet, but he was the first one in a long time. And I didn't
know,
you know.
By then they regarded him as the last prophet.
The last prophet, okay, so he's the first, he's the last prophet. But prophets generally didn't have successors. I'm trying to look back into the Old Testament and think. Certainly no one wanted to follow Jesus because he got crucified, at least as leader of whatever Jesus was the leader of. But again, my question is, what was the thing to which they were aspiring?
Okay. In the 7th century, there was no distinction between politics and religion, especially in the Middle East. Politics and religion, and still in many parts of the Middle East, are inextricably bound up with each other. Religion does not exist in and of itself in a separate realm.
Mm-hmm.
When we say that Muhammad was the leader of the religion of Islam, it wasn't actually thought of as a religion. It was more thought of more as deen, like Deen Ibrahim, the path or the way of Abraham. It was not a religion per se, but a way of being in the world, which included social and political relations and so on. By the time he died, Muhammad was the head of a huge community, had united most of the tribes of Arabia, had given a new sense of identity to Arabic speakers and so on, and a new sense of power, of the power that they could achieve united instead of squabbling among themselves, as it were. And of course, this immense body of revelations called the Quran, mm-hmm. which was, you know, a kind of a guide which everybody could accept because it was in such beautiful Arabic. It was you had the Hebrew Bible revealed, as it were, in Hebrew. You'd had the Christian Bible revealed, as it were, in Aramaic and in Greek. But here was, as far as they were concerned, the word of God in their own language, in Arabic, and in the most beautiful Arabic anyone had ever heard. So this immense sense of identity and the sense of empowerment that comes with that identity was, of course, also political. So, you know, by the time he died, a community that had great political power, great economic power, because not only from the trading and so on, and from pilgrimage to Mecca, but also because part of swearing allegiance to Islam and of partnership with Islam for each tribe was, of course, you know, a payment of taxes,
mm-hmm.
so some form of taxes, so. It was quite wealthy, too. I mean, we're talking about a lot of power involved here. And this is when things get ugly, when people start arguing over power. And I think, in fact, you will find that most religious arguments, or things that we take as theological arguments, are, in fact, not about theology. They're about power,
mm-hmm.
about very, very worldly power.
Mm-hmm. So what is Abu Bakr is the immediate successor, and he is called the caliph. Is that correct?
Yes, Abu Bakr was made the first caliph. Now, caliph comes from khalifa in Arabic, which means successor,
mm-hmm.
and in English we make that caliph, C-A-L-I-P-H.
Mm-hmm.
Ali did eventually become caliph, but only he was the fourth caliph. So he is known in Sunni Islam as the fourth caliph, and very, very much honored and respected in Sunni Islam as the fourth caliph. But in Shia Islam, because they do not recognize the three caliphs that came before him, they don't even recognize the caliphate, and they call him the first imam, the first leader, leader with a capital L. So his Ali is a central figure here. In fact, the whole of the central portion of the book is about him. He's also, by the way, the central figure, or a very, very central figure after Muhammad, of course, in Sufi Islam. And a man sort of, I think every Muslim will tell you how much regard they have for his in Arabic it comes out as nobility, but it's sort of grace and elegance and goodness of character and so on.
But the kind of interesting thing I was going to say is that through three really, I don't know if they're successionary struggles, but through three passages of power, that is from Abu Bakr to Umar, and then Uthman, he stands aside. Even though people are looking at him thinking, yes, he really should, it's his turn. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's what I mean by this nobility of character. He said every time, he said, you know, I don't want to divide the community. I don't want to be the source of division within the community. And division, fitna, which is a sort of very division with a lot of antipathy within the community, is one of the nightmares of Islam. It's considered almost a kind of sin in itself. There's a great emphasis on unity and on egalitarianism within Islam. And this is what Ali was trying to uphold when he finally, and in fact the way he did finally come to power as the fourth caliph is very, was as a result of assassination of the third caliph, Uthman, who sounds fairly corrupt. And even then it was challenged, and it was challenged by, of all people, the daughter of the first caliph, Abu Bakr, Aisha, who led an army against him. Now I know this goes entirely against everything we tend to think about, you know, Muslim women in the West. But in fact, a central figure here is Aisha, by then the youngest widow of Muhammad, but absolutely central to the story. Now, you know, whether you like her or you don't like her, right, she's outspoken. I mean, she's out there and she's involved. She's whenever she can be, she's center stage, and she's truly the antithesis of our usual image of Muslim women. In fact, this army of 10,000 men she led against Ali, she is right there in the middle of it. She's in a howdah, an armored howdah on top of a red camel. And in fact, it's called the Battle of the Camel. And it took place, by the way, not at all, by the way, it took place, and this is essential, sorry, not in Arabia, but in Iraq, just outside Basra, in southern Iraq. And in this battle, you know, I mean, there are wonderful accounts of her, you know, hurtling these blood-curdling cries to urge her men on to battle, and they're being falling all around her, being killed all around her, and so on. And of a howdah had the chainmail over it, being so studded with arrows that it looked like it was a porcupine. Finally, Ali gave the order to hobble the camel, to hamstring the camel, and the camel collapsed, and then she went quiet. And he acted towards her in victory with this immense, again, this immense generosity and nobility. One could almost say, in fact, that Ali was too noble for his own good. Forgave her, sent her back to Mecca with full honors and so on and so on, never held a grudge against her. And it was this, was actually this kind of nobility that led to his assassination. And that's a fascinating story, because those who assassinated him were his own followers who had turned against him because they claimed that he was too accommodating, that he was too, he had given away too much. He had agreed to arbitration after a battle with the man who would take over as caliph and found the Umayyad dynasty. And they disagreed with this. They wanted to fight on to the death and so on. And they accused him, Ali, of not being Islamic enough. In other words, they were the first Islamic fundamentalists. They were called the Khawariji. And when they started, one of their battle cries was a line from the Quran, judgment belongs to God alone. In other words, what they meant by that was that Ali had no right to make any judgment about arbitration or about forgiveness and so on and so on. Only God could do that. Exactly what Ali could do was not quite clear in that case. But when one of the Khawarij assassinated him at the entrance to the mosque in Najaf, again, in Iraq, mm-hmm. It's 25 miles south of present-day Baghdad, what he shouted was, judgment belongs to God alone, Ali. Which is amazing because it is such a perfect picture to my mind of the radical, extreme, fundamentalist mindset, claiming to act in the name of God. This assassin acted as though he were God. Mm-hmm. Saying that judgment belongs to God alone, he acted as though he were God and carried out, you know, the last sentence and carried out judgment and carried it out, mm-hmm. Which is very much what I would call the fundamentalist mindset. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's, to me, actually anti-God. You know, mm-hmm. to claim to act in the name of God means that you claim to act as though you were God, mm-hmm. which, you know, in religious terms, I would call heresy, but since I'm not religious, I'll just say that in lay terms, it is the most outstanding arrogance, which, by the way, is something that the Quran constantly and consistently warns against. Mm-hmm. So I'm just fascinated by this the use, this very, very early use of the Quran in such a distorted way, in the same way that I think all fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, Jewish fundamentalists, well as Islamist fundamentalists, distort their own holy books and basically almost turn them on their heads, turn the whole message of them topsy-turvy, mm-hmm. upside down.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I have lots of questions about this. One of the things that comes to mind is the kind of exegetical tradition in both Judaism and Christianity. That is that while the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Jewish Bible, and the Christian Bible are the revealed truths, they are open to interpretation, and there is an interpretative tradition. Is this true in Islam? I mean, is there a long exegetal
tradition? Most definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely. Mm-hmm. There is such a huge body of commentary on the Quran mm-hmm. alone, let alone the whole body of hadith, of reports of Muhammad's sayings and behavior and practice and so on, that the Mishnah and the Talmud look like, you know, a kind of brief by comparison. I spent last year, you know, as preparation for the book I'm now writing, I spent 3 months. I actually thought it would take 3 weeks, which is just an indication of pure hubris on my part. But I spent 3 months reading the Quran as closely as I could. Mm-hmm. I was using 4 different translations, plus a transliteration, plus the original Arabic, plus, mm-hmm. of course, a dictionary, since my Arabic is really almost totally gone. I mean, I can wield a dictionary, but not much else by now. But it took me 3 months. Mm-hmm. And by the time I finished, I thought, you know, it's time to look at the commentaries. Mm-hmm. And I started looking at the commentaries, and I thought, Leslie, you would need 3 lifetimes
yeah.
to go through these in the same kind of detail. Mm-hmm. An immense body of work mm-hmm. of the, you know, hugely varying quality, of course, but just immense. And yes, there is an enormous amount of room for interpretation, not least because the Quran itself doesn't claim to be unambiguous. In fact, there is one mm-hmm. verse that makes it quite clear. It says some of these verses are clear and some of these verses are ambiguous. And mm-hmm. then it goes on to say, well, the perverse at heart, we eagerly seek out the ambiguities, mm-hmm. trying to pin down meanings of their own to distort them for their own ends. Mm-hmm. Only God knows the true meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, only God knows the true meaning is another thing that is very often forgotten mm-hmm. by people who are convinced that they know the true meaning, and only they. And mm-hmm. if you do not agree with their truth, then you are damnably wrong.
Mm-hmm. I see. So mm-hmm. one of the things you say in the book, and I'm not terribly familiar with the Quran, to be honest with you, is that it is strictly forbidden for Muslims, for followers of the Prophet, to kill one another. Strictly forbidden. But they found a way to get around this.
Yes. And this, too, was... This is what is meant by fitna. Muslims killing Muslims. It's a reference to civil war. And all throughout the story of what happened the first 50 years after Muhammad's death, Ali was assassinated just 25 years later, and then the pivotal moment, the massacre in which Ali's son Hussein was killed, happened just 25 years after that. In other words, Muhammad himself had not yet been dead 50 years, and you get this incredible rift sort of crystallized. And you know, the shock went around the Muslim world that the son-in-law and first cousin of the Prophet had been assassinated, but then that the Prophet's grandson, like, had been assassinated. It was and in such a way, which, you know, we'll get to in a moment. But the I'm sorry, what was the question?
Yeah, the question was how they managed to get around.
It wasn't getting around it.
Okay.
It was regarded as a tragedy from the very, very beginning. It was the one thing everybody most wanted to avoid, and it was the one thing they could not avoid.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how human is that?
Yeah.
How real is that?
I guess my question is, if they're strictly forbidden, I think what you say in the book is that they are strictly forbidden to kill other Muslims, but so they take the route of defining people or basically excommunicating people, but saying people are not acting in a Muslim way.
Distorted or turned against the religion and therefore no longer real Muslims and so on. And again, that's the very fundamentalist mindset that determines who is in and who is out, the in-group versus the out-group. And that's, that you will find at the edges of every religion.
Mm-hmm.
This very loud and very ugly minority who will do this.
Uh-huh.
And they're the ones who, for instance, the Battle of the Camel, with 10,000 men led by Ali, 10,000 men led by Aisha on her red camel, just outside Basra. That battle almost did not take place. They were negotiating in the middle of the field. You had these two armies ranged against each other. There was a tent set up between them. And Ali and Aisha's representatives were negotiating in the middle of the tent, in the middle of the field there, in the tent, and were very, very close to agreement to separate without battle, right? And then one tiny faction, and still nobody's quite sure who, one tiny faction, but half a dozen young hotheads began fighting, and boom, it just spread.
Mm-hmm.
We had this enormous battle in which there were hundreds and hundreds of deaths, and there's a very, very moving account of Ali afterwards walking the battlefield, making sure that everyone is buried with full honors, both those who had fought with him and those who had fought against him, and
mm-hmm.
praying for them and berating himself for having been the cause of Muslims killing Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
It is considered the ultimate nightmare
mm-hmm.
in Islam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is why the vast majority of Muslims worldwide are so utterly against all forms of suicide bombing and terrorism, simply because it's wrong, because it is clearly forbidden in the Quran, but also they're killing Muslims.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's Muslims killing Muslims.
Yeah.
But also killing, taking any kind of innocent life.
Mm-hmm, I see. So let's move the story forward to, in a way, Ali is the pivotal figure here, but I think in another way it is his son, Hussein. Tell us the story of Hussein and his martyrdom from the point of view of the Shia.
Yes. Okay, Ali is killed. He's assassinated. And the first Umayyad caliph takes over with his headquarters in Damascus. Also, by the way, a cousin of a more distant cousin of Muhammad. And you have to realize that to call it a family dispute is kind of absurd, because everybody was related one way or another to everybody else in Mecca and in Medina at the time. There's three or four different ways, in fact, to each other. This was a fairly small community originally. The Umayyad Caliphate is seen by people in Iraq who had supported Ali as corrupt, as autocratic. Is this beginning to sound familiar? As a dictatorship. And what they do is Hussein has been persuaded after his father was killed to go back and sort of live quietly in Mecca, in Medina, in fact. And what they did is in Kufa, which is present-day Najaf, they called on him. This call went out to him. Come, travel from Arabia. Come here. We will form an army under your leadership, and we will topple the dictator. And we will establish a just and egalitarian and et cetera, right? And mm-hmm. Basically, a kind of prototype of democracy. And Ali and Hussein did. And there's many, many debates about what he knew and what he did not know, because he set out with just 72 warriors and his family, women and children, across all of Arabia to Iraq. Did he know what was happening? Did he really imagine that he could topple? I mean, by then the Umayyad dynasty was so powerful. Had so many soldiers, and it was such an incredibly strong repressive regime. Did he really imagine this was going to happen, or was it more? And it's debate about this. Or was he acting more like Christ? And I mean this literally, because you can see in posters, for instance, of Hussein, which are sold in marketplaces and mosques all over Iraq and Iran and Lebanon and Bahrain and wherever the large Shia populations, you will see posters of him in certain ways. He stands that Westerners say, why is that poster of Jesus there? He stands, the look and so on, is very, very Jesus-like. And in fact, so did he know that he was heading towards massacre? Was he willing to sacrifice himself, knowing, what a shock it would be for the grandson of Muhammad, of the Prophet, to be killed in this way? Did he hope to shock the Muslim world, the empire, out of its corruption and so on? Or was he just naive? And, of course, there's great debate about which of these two or anywhere in between it was. But in any case, travel he did. And despite all the warnings, and there were a lot of warnings of what he was heading towards, that the people in Iraq would not stand by him. Their hearts were in the right, they were in the right place, but their swords were not. And they would be, too cowed by the dictatorship. But he ignored all the warnings. And what he said was, man travels in darkness. Oh, I can't remember it now. Man travels in darkness and... Well, I don't remember the exact quote now. It's in the book, but it was to the effect that this was his destiny.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And when he got to Iraq, he wasn't even allowed near the town. He was intercepted by the caliph's soldiers, and after some to and froing, allowed to continue northwards along the Euphrates River, but not to go anywhere near the town itself, and. He went north and until they reached a place now called Karbala, which means the place of grief and disappointment. And at that point was just, it's now a huge city with the shrine of Hussein, of course, at the center. But at that time it was just a stony stretch of desert.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the women and children exhausted and so on, he set up camp. And that is where he was surrounded, 72 warriors, by 10,000 warriors. No, sorry, 4,000. 4,000 warriors sent by the caliph. And what happened then was a siege. Basically, they were cut off from the water of the river. So the intent was to drive them to submission by thirst, right? To withhold any kind of access to water from them, instead of having to actually fight them.
Mm-hmm.
And it took 10 days. And in those 10 days, there were all kinds of stories of, there were various encounters of one-on-one private duels, basically, between, members of Ali's family and the surrounding army. And you get stories of great bravery of warriors like Abbas, his Hussein's stepbrother, trying to get to the river to bring water for the children and being ambushed on the way back. you get stories of Hussein coming out from the tents and pleading for water, at least for the children, holding up his infant son in his arms, and in reply all he gets is an arrow in the neck of the son, and that's one of the images, of course, as he holds up his son, that's most taken for an image of Christ holding up an infant child. And then at the very end, on the last day, and this all happened during Muharram, the month of Muharram, there is the final battle, and Hussein himself is killed. The heads of he and his warriors are cut off. The women and children are taken captive and paraded in Damascus with the caliph and the heads rolled in front of him and so on and so on. It was just degradation of the utmost degree. And as I say, shock went round the whole of the empire at this. Not great enough shock, because it took some time for the Umayyad dynasty to fall. And on the other hand, it can be said that the man who was the first Umayyad caliph, Muawiyah, it's a wonderful name, Muawiyah, very, very sort of almost the picture of the perfect Byzantine politician, very, very savvy, very crafty, very skilled, let's say, in the exercise of power. In a way, it could be said, and this is a silly claim, of course, is that he saved the Muslim empire, that without him, it would have fallen into complete discord and mm-hmm. fractionalized and would never have achieved the power that it did. And this is also an excellent argument. But, you know, what I try and do when I'm telling the story is to tell, you know, to have respect for the story itself, to tell the story, to let the reader decide, make up his or her mind about, you know, what is right or what is wrong here, to make the judgment, as a consequence of which I've had emails and letters from some Sunni Muslims saying that I'm horribly and wrongly biased towards the Shia, which are balanced by almost the same amount of comments and letters from Sunni Muslims, from Shia Muslims, saying that I'm biased and towards mm-hmm. the Sunni side of things, which makes me think, of course, that somehow or other I have managed to do what I was trying to do all along, which mm-hmm. is to not take sides and just let the story tell itself. Mm-hmm. This immense, powerful story, which, by the way, you know, is not merely history in the way that we think of history in the West. You see, in the Middle East, what happened 1,400 years ago is as alive and as real and as vivid in people's minds as if it happened yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
There is not that idea of history as then. It's always now as well as then.
Mm-hmm.
This fascinates me, this bridging of now and then, which is something I've tried to do, you know, in all my work in the last several years since I've been working in this area, as it were, both Mary and Jezebel, and then after the Prophet, and then with the book I'm working on now, I'm going to be trying to do it again, is to bridge that awful gap which makes us in the West look at events in the past as though we're looking through the wrong end of a telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And they all become smaller, right? And we simplify things immensely and have no respect for their complexity or for the sheer human messiness of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we don't have much respect for either complexity or human messiness about what's happening right now. I mean, just look at all the nonsense being spouted about, you know, Egypt and Bahrain and what happens if, you know, the Shia take over and Iran's going to expand its sphere of influence, or if the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Sunni, is going to expand its sphere of influence and so on and so on. All these are perfect nonsense and totally exaggerated, right? And it's really not about Shia and Sunni what's happening now. It's about exactly the things that President Obama spoke about in Cairo 20 months ago, which is democracy, freedom, and dignity.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, let's leave all that punditry aside for the moment. And where was I?
Well, one of the things you were saying is that the past is very much alive for these people. And I ask, I kind of, we're about to run out of time, but I want to ask a question about that. I don't know how to best put it, but one of the ways in which you reach an accommodation with someone with whom you've had trouble is forgetting about the past, is putting it aside. Does the fact that these people hold the past to be very present, does that hinder that that possibility?
I don't think so. You know, we think of the Shia-Sunni split as indelible. But here's the thing about it. It has not been pure conflict for 1,400 years. In fact, for most of those 1,400 years, Shia and Sunni have lived side by side in perfect tolerance. Maybe not perfect harmony, but certainly in tolerance. Coexistence, in other words. But it can always be used. It can always be... The story that I tell in After the Prophet can always be manipulated politically. Ayatollah Khomeini manipulated it for his ends in the 1979-1980 revolution in Iran. He used images from it, images of Hussein at Kabul, for instance, in order to get people riled up. The images of it come again and again. For instance, the Shah of Iran was called Yazid, who was the caliph who ordered the massacre at Kabul. George Bush was called Yazid when he invaded Iraq. These are images that come up again and again. What's interesting about what's happening now, I think, is that they are not coming up. Not in Bahrain, which is 70% Shia, under, so far, still, Sunni rule. This isn't theological, what's happening now. It really is about... I mean, you know, what we have now is the stunning sight of people willing to die for and being killed for the right to self-determination, to democracy, and feeling very empowered in this demand of democracy. And yet we look at it and we say, oh, but are they ready for democracy? I mean, what an absurd question.
Yeah.
And in fact, there is a wonderful article by Nick Kristof, a column by Nick Kristof in the New York Times of February 27th, about exactly that, just exploding that wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
You mean someone's willing to die for democracy and you're saying that they're not ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
Give me a break.
Yeah, so let me ask a question that I think will occur to a lot of people who listen to the show, and I think particularly people in the United States, and that is people will sometimes try to make an analogy between the Sunnis and the Shia and Protestants and Catholics within Christianity. But I mean, everything you've said to me said that they're really not very analogous at all.
No, they're not.
I mean, I was trying to think to myself, sorry to go on for a second, but, you know, I was trying to think to myself, if a Protestant, at least that wasn't in Northern Ireland, let's put it that way, if a Protestant that was not in Northern Ireland tried to think back about a Catholic atrocity against Protestants, I don't know where they would go. The St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, that occurred in the 16th century. Nobody remembers that. I mean, nobody who's not a historian. So there's the past really is gone. Yeah.
The parallel is there, though, when it comes to political manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this identity as, you know, whether your Shia or your Sunni identity takes priority is partly a matter of you know, political events, of current events. And this, of course, can always be manipulated.
Yeah, no, I suspect that's what we saw
happening, you know, in Iraq and in Iran. It's what we're not seeing happening now. In fact, we're seeing a very, very determined effort not to let that happen, for instance, in Bahrain, which I utterly admire.
Well, me too. So anyway, we've taken up a lot of your time, and this is fascinating. I could go on forever about this, primarily because I don't know anything about it. I confess my ignorance. I'm a little bit ashamed. We've been talking to Leslie Hazelton about her book, After the Prophet. Leslie, we usually end this show with a traditional final question, and it is this. What are you working on now?
Well, it'll probably come as no surprise after what I've been saying, but what I'm writing now is a new biography of Muhammad in which my basic question is, who was he? I want to get a real feel for him as a man, for who he was, for what it was, as it were, to be Muhammad.
And when were you going to expect that?
Well, I'm hoping to finish writing it by the end of the year, which would mean publication in fall of next year, but wish me luck.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, I do wish you luck. And I thank you very much for writing the book and taking the time to talk to us. Again, we've been talking to Leslie Hazelton about her book, After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split. Leslie, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you, Marshall.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Leslie Hazelton about her new book, After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.